History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam, and welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario, where I have a lot of friends who are history teachers in this city, and one of the things we talk about a lot is how to get kids interested in history, because oftentimes it can be a tough sell to kids, especially below the high school level, and even though at the high school level it's still a tough sell. But for particularly younger kids, it can be really tough to get them into history. And our guest today is working hard to change that perception of history. He's written a book called Brothers at War, a Novel. And we welcome into the podcast, Don Kummer. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for coming over.
I'm interested in this book because it's a historical fiction of the War of 1812. And I'm just curious, just in general, though, how do you get involved in writing historical fiction? What's the motivation to write a book like this?
Well, when I was the age that this book is aimed at kids, say, 9 to 12, 13, 14 years old, middle grade. When I was that age, this is the kind of stuff I used to devour. And some of the great historical novelists were hard at work at that time. You know, Rosemary Sutcliffe was selling, and we still had, there was a guy, Canadian named John Hayes, that was publishing stuff, and I used to devour it. And from that time to this, I've wanted to be a writer. And I did my studies in history with an eye to writing historical fiction eventually. Did my master's at Carleton on research in on the opening of the Canadian West, as I was working on a novel about the people who were fighting against Louis Riel, Charles Mayer, and Charles Schultz, and those guys. And so I've always wanted to do this. Just in the last few years, I've turned my attention to children's literature rather than mainstream or adult, and it turns out I'm quite good at it.
Yes, and you've had a lot of experience writing, like your career before moving into an author. You worked in the Prime Minister's office.
Yeah, I was in the
with correspondence. So your job was writing.
Yeah.
Obviously a different type of writing, but you're a writer.
And I've been a professional speech writer for years. I worked in the Prime Minister's office for a good bit, and then I hung up my shingle as a professional speech writer. It's amazing how good you get at turning things around really fast. Just for all the writers out there, and you know, you've read Malcolm Gladwell's thing about the 10,000 hours.
Yep.
And I figured, I've been writing for years, making tough, tight deadlines. I figure I've had my 10,000 hours. How hard can it be to write a book for 10-year-olds? Well, it turns out it's really hard. I had to learn how to write all over again in order to find a way to tell a story that would appeal to a young reader.
Yeah, because that's one of the things, reading the reviews of this book, a lot of people said that you really found the voice of kids because you're writing about younger people.
Yeah.
The characters in the book are younger. And people who have reviewed the book have said you really found that voice. Mm-hmm. So what was the process of finding that voice, and how do you do it, given that you're not a kid anymore?
Well, I think, there's an inner 12-year-old in all of us. Maybe for some of us it's an inner 8-year-old. I was really helped. I had my own son. This story actually evolved because we'd be taking long trips to hockey tournaments, and so I'd start telling these stories about imagining what it would be like if you were in a battlefield like Lundy's Lane, and you were on one side of the battlefield and your father was on the other side. Mm. And it was that image of a battle at Lundy's Lane, which is fought in a graveyard in the middle of the night, and a father and a son facing off on the other side, on different sides of the war, that got me really thinking about this. And eventually I started telling the story, writing the story the way that I would have told it to my son, and somehow I tapped into that inner 12-year-old. Mm. I think the thing that I really had to learn about writing for children is that the momentum must never slow down. This, you have to write it so that you turn those pages, and that was a long haul to learn that lesson. I had to dynamite the bridges and begin again a few times, but I had some great help, great advice.
And because you also wrote a story called The Burying Grounds, which won the Writing Union of Canada's 2012 award for writing for children. It's a competition.
Yeah.
And that story is in the book.
Yeah, it's a chapter in the book.
And Was winning that award or the process of writing that story maybe the impetus behind putting it into the book or blowing out the book further?
The story, I took a chapter that I had already written for the book and submitted it as a short story. Some chapters lend themselves well that way.
Mm.
And I like to keep chapters self-contained so that there's a beginning and a middle and an end. But I also, if one thing that makes good short stories work for me is there's this element of mystery and the unknown. It's what Hemingway used to call, the iceberg theory, where you only see the very top. And especially in short stories, that's very powerful. If you get a sense that there's something huge underneath there going on, you just don't know what it is.
Mm.
And you just trust to the writer. And that particular story, it takes place in a graveyard, and it's in the book. It's sort of a pivotal chapter where things really turn around and go off in a different direction. I think what the judges sensed was that, beneath what they could see of that iceberg, there was a huge mass of ice that they didn't know about, but they knew it was there.
Mm.
And that's what made it a successful short story. It's one of the things that I used to great effect, I think, in the novel as a whole. Most of the stuff in this book is not said; it's between the lines. And I'm counting on young readers to be drawn to that. You go to these workshops and people keep saying, "Well, you got to explain what he's feeling. Tell me what he's feeling, or explain why that's happening." And my approach is different, saying, okay, no, just describe it. Just give the feeling for it and trust the reader that they will know or they will intuit and they will want to be drawn in further because they know something's going on. I think that's particularly important in historical fiction. I've read, we all read tons of historical fiction, I suppose. And the biggest mistake that I think most writers of historical fiction do make is to try to explain history.
Hmm.
And you read so many of them that it's just, some guy should have been writing nonfiction history because he has so much to say about a certain episode or period. And instead he's decided to put it into pages of turgid dialogue that doesn't sound like anything anybody would ever say.
Hmm.
And so my approach is different. My approach is to say, look, put these two characters in a compelling situation. Know the history yourself. Just infuse yourself with it so it's coming out your pores. And just let them move around in that landscape that you've created in your mind. And if you do that really well, then the reader's going to say, geez, I want to know more about that. And they'll go and they'll Google it. They'll learn their history by Google, not by what you put in your book.
So that being the case, then, you say that you want to know it. Like, how much time would you say you spent doing research before you write the book?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. The nascence of this book came back in, what was it? Was it 1987 or so when Pierre Burton came out with his popular histories of the War of
Flames Across the Border and
the invasion in Canada. Yeah. In the invasion of Canada, he talked about this guy, Joe Wilcox, who led a bunch of Canadians. He was a commander in the American Army. He had been the former member of the Assembly of Upper Canada. He was perhaps, one could argue that he was one of the first leaders of the opposition in Canadian history. He ends up fighting for the Americans. And he leads a band of renegade Canadians. Now, when I read that, I thought, my God, that's interesting. How come we don't know about this? This is Canada's Benedict Arnold. And I put it aside. I read George Stanley's Military Actions, and I started picking up what I could in the War of 1812, and I set it aside because I was working on other stuff. And then I started coming back to it, and just thought, how do you add up the years? It's years that I'm doing this. When I was in the early stages of actually writing it, I'd be up late at night. I would sort of devour everything I could. William Kirby's Annals of Niagara, Janice Corcoran's books on early Niagara, there's Shepherd's book on plunder, profit, and parole. There's all kinds of great stuff. The Dictionary of Canadian Biography. I would just get immersed in the DCB, just trying to. That was a great way to get a sense, a flavor of what a community is like. And I would go to bed with this stuff, and I'd wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and just start to write. And, and I wouldn't try to write history. I just try to let's write dialogue. Let's write a scene. But it would be based upon what I'd read the night before.
I'm wondering how much is accuracy a factor? Are you trying? Because you say you're not trying to write a history.
It's
a story that takes place in the past. So how much creative liberty can you take with events or with characters? Are you really just maybe trying to have a fictitious recreation of a circumstance that may have happened?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question. And, you know, when I was writing about the Canadian West, I was trying to make sure that I never screwed up on a historical fact or never say anything that I knew could not have happened. And I think I've let those values slip a bit, because I think that there is what a friend of mine calls poetical truth. There's historical truth and there's poetical truth. Now, some of these things, the historians will rap me over the knuckles and say, well, no, that did not happen that way. And I will say, yeah, you're probably right. And no, I try to avoid that. I really try to avoid it. But if you chain yourself to never saying anything that you know could not have happened that way, then your responsibility as a storyteller gets hobbled. So, you know, hats off. My greatest respect to the historians. I was trained as a historian. I value what a historian does. It's just one of the highest callings. That's not what I'm best at. What I'm best at is telling stories. And if I have to bend something a bit, I will. Sometimes it means converging several characters into one character. Sometimes it means taking things from one period or situations and putting them to situations where I don't know whether it happened, but it might. There's one of the chapters here involves the general election of 1812, and I have my villains in my story conduct a dirty tricks campaign to try to throw the election. Now, did that happen to Joe Wilcox in the general election of 1812? No, in fact, he won a landslide. He was very popular. But that makes for a pretty boring story. So, and did were these kinds of tricks attempted? I don't know. Well, they did do some dirty tricks in the general election of 1812. They certainly did stuff in the later period, in Canada West period. And so what I do is I just take some stuff that I know happened later, things that would happen to people like William Lyon Mackenzie, and transplant them. You know, Mackenzie's printing press was smashed when he was writing The Colonial Advocate. So I take that idea and I apply it to Joe Wilcox's printing press back in 1811.
But then, you know, because you're writing for, you say, 8 to 12, 8 to 13-year-olds, the sort of middle school type ages.
Yeah.
Is there a fear then that because you're taking some license that they might get a skewed vision of what's going on? Because this could very well be their first time that they're getting familiar with these events, with this time period. So what responsibility then is there to the kids who is your target audience?
I think if I get the period right in its general detail and its feeling and its mood, I think that they will forgive me the odd lapse. I try to avoid anachronism, which is a big challenge. My editor is the queen of the Oxford English Dictionary, and she, my story is very scatological. One of the characters is a tanner's son, and a tannery business back in those days included, you know, a lot of excrement. So we have to find all the words for poop, pee, piss, and who would use what word when. Part of it's a class distinction. Part of it is, you know, who knew that some of these words didn't appear in the English language until after 1850, for example.
No, because the kid gets, what does he get nicknamed, Turd Boy or something?
They call him Turd Boy because, you know, back when I go to schools, I have great fun with this. How many of you have dogs? How many of you have to clean up after your dog? Well, this is a story about a town where nobody has to clean up after their dog except for one kid. And he cleans up after everybody's dog. And the reason why he does it is they need the dog poop to make to tan leather. And the kids just go nuts for this. They love it.
Yeah. I don't care if you're 8 or if you're 28.
Yeah.
Turd Boy is going to make you laugh.
Yeah.
It's just going to make you laugh.
Yeah.
So with that target audience, then, what is your goal? What are you hoping that they take away from the book? Do you want them to... You said earlier you hope that, you know, kids don't read anymore. So you want to get kids reading, especially books. But is there part of you with your history background that wants them to get into history as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mean, this is the kind of book that I loved to read when I was a kid. And they don't write them... Actually, there's some great historical fiction being written now. And a lot of it is way better than what I grew up with. I was rereading some of the stuff that I grew up on, and I can't believe the racism and the sexism, you know, all the stuff that you'd expect. 50 years from now, somebody's going to look back at this and say, oh my God, this is bad. Look at the social values of this thing. That's the nature of time. You know, and I am getting feedback on my Facebook site, especially, that people are saying, you know, I gave this book to my 12-year-old. He never reads, and he said it was good. So, you know, I've got two goals, two dreams in this thing. One is that, you know, somewhere across Canada there's going to be some 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds who are going to pick up a book and stay away from the computer for a while. You know, who knows, maybe one day they're going to be the ones who are going to do the War of 1812 version of Assassin's Creed. I don't know. But if I can get kids reading and kids interested in history... And kids knowing that there was a War of 1812, they're getting that in the schools. Mm-hmm. B, it was not all bright lights and glory. It was a very nasty, vicious civil war in which families were torn apart and neighbors fought against neighbors. And a lot of people had vendettas against their neighbors that, you know, they could take out by burning their enemy's house down. Mm-hmm. So get a sense of the War of 1812 as a very compelling story that just isn't, you know, Isaac Brock leading a charge. It's a lot more complex. And two, you know, I would be delighted if somebody, you know, of a really good historian, maybe it'll, you know, as you say, it's this 12-year-old boy who reads the story will grow up and say, you know what, that guy Cummer, he wrote this book about Joe Wilcox. And there's a lot of stuff in there that didn't really happen. I am going to write the first serious biography of Joe Wilcox, which I think is way overdue. Wilcox is just one of the most interesting and least studied people in our history. He's our Benedict Arnold. And Benedict Arnold himself is such a complex and wonderful character, and so is Wilcox. There's a great deal of debate. You know, maybe there's a couple of hundred people across the country who... know who Wilcox is and what he did and think about it seriously, and their range of opinion about him would go from he's a charlatan and he was just out, you know, he didn't care who he hurt and burned in order to pursue his own career, to, you know, he was a principled Whig politician who was the father of modern progressive politics. You know, the truth is going to be somewhere between those two extremes. But certainly he deserves a good biography.
You kind of alluded to it a little bit. The book itself, obviously historical fiction of the War of 1812, but the premise, no, we don't want to give away too much, obviously, but the basic premise of the book is that they're kids who grow up together and then are sort of pitted on opposite sides.
Well, I'll give you my elevator pitch.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Jake and Eli are growing up in the border community of Newark. And they've sworn an oath of allegiance to each other as blood brothers. And nothing is going to stand between them, not the bullies they're fighting against, not their parents, not the teachers. But the one thing that they haven't counted upon is that the War of 1812 is coming. Now, this is a series. Book one takes you to the point at which Eli is the new kid in town. He's the American. His father refuses to swear an oath of allegiance to the king.
Hmm.
So already he's suspect.
It's going to be trouble. Yeah.
It's trouble.
It's trouble.
And by the end of the war, by the end of the book,
mm-hmm.
he decides to go back to the States.
Mm.
The end of the book is, you know, mid-June 1812. The boys don't know it yet, but war has been declared. So book two, which is, you know, we're still, book two is with the editor now, that starts with Queenston Heights.
Okay.
And that's all I'll say about it right now.
Okay, okay. All right, but needless to say, so the war is the impetus for the conflict,
yeah,
between the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in this book, at least, the prospect of war, because so the adults are familiar with what's going on and they're involved,
yeah,
in some level in the ideological differences between the British and,
yeah,
the Americans, and the kids are sort of stuck almost,
yeah,
right? And then they're, so it's an interesting idea to see how this the effects on the community through, mm-hmm, the eyes of the kids.
Yeah,
right? I like the way that that's structured. Now, why would you want to write a historical fiction on the War of 1812?
It began with a lot of thought about what happens to a community that's torn apart by civil war. Now, Alan Taylor's book has made popular this notion of the War of 1812 as a civil war. I've been thinking this for years. And it occurs to me that my view is that every generation of Canadians has got a huge question that they have to ask themselves in the geopolitical sense, and that is, what is our relationship going to be with the United States? And every generation answers it in its own way. For my generation, it was the free trade election, and I was involved in that, you know, when I was working in politics. And so I started thinking about how, if you followed a family generation by generation, and you go back, say, to the American Revolution, and you take somebody who's, I wound up, my son and I were puttering around upstate New York, and we came upon a battle I hadn't heard of before called Oreskany. And it's a very interesting battle, because it was basically fought between neighbors in the Mohawk Valley, and some of them were loyalists and some of them were patriots. It was part of the much bigger Saratoga campaign. And the way that the battle was fought, at one point, the British tried to use a ruse. They tried to turn their coats inside out so that they looked like the American, like the Patriot soldiers. They would be mistaken, and they tried to get close enough that way. And some guy recognizes his neighbor as one of these guys. You know, so that detail just planted the seed of that. What would it be like to be those people?
Mm.
The guy who's got his coat turned inside out, and the guy, you know, 20 feet away who's, hey, wait a minute, that's you.
Yeah.
One of the interesting characters in this book is the father of Jacob. And the father is, I think of the father as the guy who had his coat turned inside out. And so now he's living in Upper Canada as a refugee, United Empire loyalist.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to raise his son with the right values. And his son has this American friend that he has sworn his allegiance to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be part of the spine for the longer story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But is that interest personal for you as well in seeing this, the War of 1812, as this national events, and trying to get, because there's been so much commemoration about it and the TV commercials, there was the exhibit at the War Museum, so on and so forth. I mean, is this part of a wider push? Do you see yourself as part of this wider push to sort of reclaim the War of 1812?
I was doing this, I started doing this before the Prime Minister decided that he was going to spend a lot of money promoting the war. You know, certainly it's been helping me. I don't have to explain to Canadians what the War of 1812 is.
Right.
Had this book come out 10 years ago, I wouldn't have a clue. The first thing I do when I go into a classroom is say, okay, put up your hand if you know what the War of 1812 is. And everybody's hand goes up. And the next question I ask is, who won? And everybody says, we did!
Yeah.
And that's where I take off and say, okay, well, what does that mean? Let's take a look at why do we say we did?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we say you know, who lost? And we get into quite a discussion about what were the objectives of various sides. You see, this is, you know, going back, Sean, to the uses of history and historical fiction, I go into the classroom with this and we get into a really interesting discussion about what the War of 1812 was about. And in that case, it doesn't matter that, you know, I invented some tricks in the general election of 1812.
Mm-hmm.
What's really important is we talk about why was there a war? What did First Nations want to gain from siding with the British?
Mm-hmm.
Why were the British, you know, willing to go to war against the Americans anyway? What were they doing?
Right.
What were the American objectives? Was it important to them whether or not they took Canada?
Yeah.
Were there other things that were more important to them?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we get into that kind of discussion. And for the kids, you know, this is just Jake and Eli's world, you know, come to life, and trying to see what are the underpinnings of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that historical fiction is very useful, because it gets you thinking. You know, there's a world out there. Lots of it is familiar. You know, there's bullies in this book. There's bullies in my school. There's teachers that are mean. There's you know, relations with fathers. There's you know, single dads. But the interesting thing is, what is this strange world that seems a bit different, where nobody picks up dog poop except for Turd Boy, and he's made fun of.
Yeah, I was in a high school class in September. My buddy Dave asked me to come in and talk about some stuff, and mm-hmm. I don't know why, but one of the kids asked me who won the War of 1812, mm-hmm. and so I launched into a similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really just ask that simplistic question.
Yeah.
It's, you got to look at what everybody wanted. And
yeah.
You could make a case, this is why I thought the exhibit at the War Museum was so good, mm-hmm. that it had the four different perspectives.
Yes.
And it said that pretty much everyone could make a case that they got what they wanted, with the exception of the First Nations people,
yeah.
who got completely hosed in the whole deal, from all three other sides.
Yeah.
That's really the cool part about history to me, is that it has this nuance to it,
yeah.
and that you can debate and go back and forth and really analyze. And it's not this recessive, you're not just stating dates and events,
yeah.
and going over it, which I think is too much what happens in schools.
You think still? I mean,
it was my experience.
Yeah, it was mine too. But I keep on thinking that, you know, sometimes we miss that. I'm not sure whether my son's 16 and he grew up as my son, so he's got history coming out of his pores. But
yeah.
I'm not sure he knows any dates.
Right.
You know, because I don't think that's how they teach it.
Mm.
So when I go into a class, actually, I do do stuff with dates,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it could be very revealing. You know,
I was in the class and I showed, we did a map on the site, or Tom Peace did it, of what is Canadian history. And he basically took all the words from the CAJ program and put them into this, like a mind map type thing. And which ones were the biggest were the ones which were there the most often. And the word Indigenous was there.
Hmm.
And my buddy Dave, the teacher, stopped me after I said the word. And he said, "No, you're going to have to explain what that means."
Mm-hmm.
And this is to a 10th grade.
Yeah.
Class.
Yeah, you'd think they'd know by then.
That was some, that concerned me somewhat.
Well, you know, but, you know, Indigenous, you know, how many words do we have for First Peoples? Indigenous, Aboriginal, First Nation, it's, you know, I guess we don't use Indian anymore. It's one of the interesting things about writing a book like this, is you have to use the old vocabulary.
Right.
So, and so Eli, the American, yeah, and I have fun with my editor on this, because she just flags this stuff. It's going to get through the school. And one of the first things that Eli says when he introduces himself is, "Looks Injun. Your pa's friend with Injuns?" And, you know, Indigenous is at one extreme of what the vocabulary is. I don't know whether a 10-year-old, 12-year-old kid will know what an Injun is anymore.
Yeah.
I-N-J-U-N is the way we spell it in the story. But, you know, you talk about wanting your historical accuracy. That is, well, actually, there are a lot more racist and derogatory terms that Eli might have used at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. In book two, we deal with Raunchy's. There's a very successful and interesting unit in the British Army. It was a Canadian militia called Raunchy's Colored Corps, and it was, you know, African Canadians.
Hmm.
And I have, you know, the vocabulary I have to use to be authentic is vocabulary that is no longer permitted. And so we've got to find a way through that. And I'm just thinking through book two now. There's one of the things, going back to your question about what things we can make up, what things might not be historically accurate. And sometimes you have to go on a limb. I don't know what Joe Wilcox looked like. So I invent him. Mm. In book two, one of the characters is John Beverly Robinson, who is very young and newly appointed as the acting attorney general. I've seen pictures of him as an older and very successful guy on a family compact, but I have to imagine what he would have been like when he was 22. And so I make these things up. And I could be dead wrong. But I hope that, you know, the historians will come out and say, well, no, John Beverly Robinson would have done this. Basically, I base him after a friend of mine who's, people who know this friend of mine read this chapter and say, John Beverly, oh, that's Ian Mitchell. And that's what a fiction writer does, and it's up to the historians to step in and say, well, no, this is what really happened. Mm-hmm. And I hope, you know, I hope the historians will grant me the latitude to do that. Mm-hmm. I hope they'll support historical novelists when we try to do this. We're not trying to teach history. We're trying to tell stories set mm-hmm. in a historical context, and we're hoping to draw young readers so that they'll be interested in history, so you, the historians, can take over and tell them what it was really like.
Well, that's interesting, though, because does the fiction work if people don't know the events?
If they don't know the events, they don't need to know the events. What they need to know is the adventure. They just have to see Jake and Eli, in this case, responding to what's going on. You know, General Brock makes his appearances in this little town that they live in. The town is actually now Niagara-on-the-Lake. I call it Newark. They don't need to know who General Brock is other than how these boys perceive him. And the mistake that a lot of historical novelists might make is to try to give a potted biography of General Brock. You know, he was born in Guernsey, he saw action, you know, in Holland. He wished that he was back in Europe where the real action was taking place, and he's stuck here in Canada fretting away, but he's a very responsible man, and he decides that his main mission is going to be to save Canada. You know, none of that. No. Yeah. To a 12-year-old kid, what he knows about General Brock is that he's huge. Hmm. He's a big man. And he has the manners of an English gentleman. And if you're a colonial kid, you don't know how to respond to that. So Jake and Eli are a bit awkward. Well, Jake is awkward because Jake has got enough social awareness to know when he's out of his depth. Eli just says, pleased to meet you, generally, yeah. She puts out his hand, you know. He's Huckleberry Finn.
Is there a divide, too, then, between boys and girls who are going to read a book like this?
Great question. And I've had a discussion with, you know, the first review that I had on this was in our community newspaper, The Oscar. A woman who wrote it asked me, you know, couldn't you have included more girls? Well, yeah. And the female characters figure more in the second book. But really, it's not my purpose to be gender parity. Yeah. I am trying to tell a story, and this story happens to be one that I wrote initially to appeal to my then 11-year-old son. Mm. And it's the kind of story that an 11-year-old kid like my son would enjoy. Does that mean that there's not enough girls in it? Perhaps, but you know, there's no lack of great historical fiction or great fiction aimed at girls. My mentor in this is a wonderful woman named Marcia Skripik, and she writes terrific historical fiction. And actually, you know, your listeners who are serious historians might want to look into what she does. She does something completely different from me. She actually, most of her settings are in Eastern Europe in the Second World War period. And she's got I think she's probably got 17 or 18 books now, many of them set in this period. And she goes and she interviews people, you know, who are still alive, who remember that. And her latest one is called Underground, and it's about a 14-year-old boy fighting for the Ukrainian resistance. And they have to fight against the Nazis and they have to fight against the Soviets. And in order to do this, and there's not a lot written, I suppose there's primary sources somewhere, very, very little in the secondary sources. Mm. And so what she does is she married into the community and she goes and talks to people who are there and remember. And so, I hope, I don't know what Marcia does with her, with her notes on her interviews, but somebody could use those as primary sources. But what she does, the fiction that she turns with this original research is marvelous. Skrypuch, Skrypuch. If anybody is interested in following that up.
Now, in that same vein, then, do you think that maybe what she's doing or what you're doing is that the best way to initiate kids into history? To tell these stories through fiction in maybe a more entertaining way, and then hope that triggers something that they want to go learn about these events wider. Because I think, at least I'm sure people at a museum would tell you that the best way to get them interested is to bring them to the museum and have them play with some artifacts or
stuff
like that. Or is it just sort of whatever that particular kid is into?
Let a thousand flowers blossom. Yeah. My particular route into being interested in history was through the historical fiction I read. I don't know, Sean, were you different? Was it a museum?
No, for me it was... I wasn't really into it until I got to high school and we got into like the debates and stuff.
Yeah.
That's really what got me going.
Yeah.
And thinking, oh, this is actually interesting. Because again, my experience in, 6th through 10th grade was just remember these dates.
Yeah.
And I really didn't like it. And there was an event in 8th grade where I was in the hall because it was history class and I was being disruptive because I was bored out of my head.
Yeah.
And the teacher came out to talk to me and she said, well, what are you doing? I said, history is so stupid.
Yeah.
And because it was like, this happened. I don't like.
Who cares?
Yeah, there was no context to it. Once we started putting context to it, that's when I got really interested to it. And I was the 12-year-old kid who didn't read either.
Yeah.
Like, we would have reading days, and I just wouldn't, like, I would play cards or do something. Yeah. And, like, today, the kid who would be on his phone or something, like, that was me. So that's when I got into it. But I will concede that it would have been better if I had gotten into it when I was 8.
Yeah.
Or 12 or anywhere, like younger, either through these books or through museums or something.
And there's so many other ways too. I mean, the museums are one way. I think that there's going to be a whole generation of historians who were first intrigued by playing Assassin's Creed and watching the Borgias on TV or
the Civilization game.
The Civilization game, yes.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, everything I learned out of life, I learned playing Civilization.
No, but I guess it just depends on the kid and what that particular kid is going to be interested in.
Yep.
In going into classrooms, what's the sense that you're getting from the kids that this is something that they want to pursue further or learn more about the events, or are they more concerned with the story and the adventure part of it?
I get a sense that once you start talking about it, they're quite curious. And they ask great questions.
Yeah.
Just mind-blowingly simple but profound questions. Mm. Like when I start talking about why the Americans were fighting the war and the way that the impressment of sailors, the freedom of the high seas, and impressing upon them that the United States was a young nation and it really had no respect internationally or diplomatically. And one kid puts up his hands and said, how did the Americans get to be so powerful?
What a great question.
Yeah. Because, for these kids, it is inconceivable that 200 years ago, the United States is the new kid on the block and it has to prove itself against the bullies. It has to stand up to the bullies. and poor little Upper Canada gets burnt, scorched as a result. And there's just such basic things. I mean, I don't know whether you'll have a cover of the cover of the book on the website.
Yeah,
we'll
post it.
But the cover is a big Union Jack, and the Union Jack is torn in half. And one of the things I do is say, okay, whose flag is that? And when I was a kid, boy, you'd know that in grade one.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, middle graders can't tell you whose flag that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to get back to some real basics about the fact that there was a British Empire.
Right.
And Canada was part of that.
Mm.
And that leads... So most of the discussion we have is on a very general, broad basis like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I start talking about, you know, a war between empires, between England and France, or Britain and France. And, you know, this is just... I might as well be starting out by saying in a galaxy far away.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the story when I was studying at Carleton. There's a friend of mine who was a teacher. This is, you know, back in the time when Japan was sort of leading the world in economic growth. And I've got to say that kids nowadays are really attuned to history a lot more than they were, you know, 20 years ago. We've come a long way. Because this teacher was in a classroom talking about the Second War. And what's the Second World War? He says, well, you know, it's the United States and Canada and Britain and the Allies versus Germany and Japan. He said, oh, no, you're kidding. There's no war like that. He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, it was just 50 years ago. No. we fought against Germany and Japan? He says, yeah. So one kid puts up his hands and he says, excuse me, sir, who won? And, you know, at the time, you'd be excused for asking because, you know, the American economy was in a recession and Japan seemed to be dominating the world. But that's just how little... Yeah, and this would have been going back...
That's
this,
me. That's that why I'm that kid.
You're that kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because nobody was... Because history was just not considered relevant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're working on your dissertation and building your career in a time when the fields are much more fertile. And thank God, I'm bringing this book out at a time when things are more... I couldn't imagine a better time to come up with a book on the War of 1812. And, you know, in a time when I can go into a classroom and say, who's here? Ask who's here has heard of the War of 1812 and every hand goes up.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, that wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of that then, that there are millions of people who grew up like me, not really interested in history, mm-hmm. who are now adults, for as much as I don't self-identify as an adult, mm-hmm. but I guess I kind of am. Would this sort of book then work for adults too? Or is it written in a way that maybe it wouldn't be as appealing?
You know what? Like, I'm going to give you a copy of this book and you're going to read it and you're going to tell me. Because I think it's written... A friend of mine once said, well, especially in the earlier drafts, you know, is this book for kids or is it just about kids? And the thing about this book is it's written in sentences and with vocabulary that hopefully a 12-year-old can understand or a 10-year-old can understand.
Mm-hmm.
But the ideas are very adult ideas.
But do you have that in mind when you're writing, like thinking about, you know, yeah, my target audience is kids, but, you know, maybe their parents are going to read it or teachers are going to read it, or are you just focused on that audience?
I'm not even focusing on that audience, you know, Sean. What I'm doing is I've got this world in my head, and you know, historians will know what that is. When I can walk the streets of Newark in 1812. It's so alive and real for me. And I'm just telling this story. And I'm telling it the best way that I know. And the best way that I know seems to be to tap that inner 12-year-old and see it the way that he would see it. You know, on your blog, I'd be interested to see what the comments are if the listeners are get a hold of Brothers at War I'd love to have a debate on this or a discussion with historians because, you know, I go through these issues all the time. You know, am I bending the facts too much here?
Mm.
can I really get away with saying this? Is this the proper, you know, I'm taking a historiographic view of something that other historians might take exception to.
Mm-hmm. But that'd be true if you're writing narrative history.
That's
right. Too, right?
Like, that's right. I'm dealing with, if I was in a seminar and I said, okay, this is my dissertation.
Yeah.
Let's discuss it from the point of view of history. And somebody would say, well, I think you got your fact wrong here, but who cares? Let's discuss about your perspective of what the War of 1812 mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. and what was really going on. I'd love to have that kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing is that now there's enough people who are studying this. I think Alan Taylor's book, The Civil War of 1812, is very... I used to have to try to explain why I thought the War of 1812 was a civil war in Upper Canada, and I'd have to explain who Joe Wilcox was and what kind of people followed him. But now with Taylor's book, you know, you can just go straight to the chase.
Right.
You know, I'm talking about the upper Canadians who fought on the American side.
Mm.
And why? And what happens to a kid who gets caught up in all of that? And I'd love to get in that kind of discussion with historians.
Mm. Well, I'll post my review as the written piece to accompany
Great.
This.
Terrific.
To this. So if people want it, where can they go? You mentioned it's a Scholastic book. So obviously through Scholastic, but...
Yeah, well, you know, for any of the listeners who have kids in school, they're going to be bringing home those Scholastic catalogs, and you can order it through Scholastic. Chapters carries it. If you're in Ottawa, Kaleidoscope Kids is one of the last independent bookstores in the city. It's been very supportive in helping me with this book.
Why? I feel as though I've walked past that before.
It's right across from Lansdowne Park.
That's right.
Yeah.
On the where they're doing the construction,
that's
on the,
right.
that condo building
yeah,
in the bottom there. That's right.
They got a little corner shop in the condo building.
Yeah, okay.
Great, you know, if any of the listeners have kids, you know, if you don't know that bookstore, check it out. They've got some great stuff in there.
Pick up a copy for yourself, for your kids, for your nieces, nephews, grandkids, whoever.
Let the debates begin.
There you go. So that is Don Comer, and the book again is Brothers at War, a novel from Scholastic Canada. Don, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for coming, Sean.
So if you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com, Twitter at Dr. Shawnee Fever, and as always, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.